It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
We're recording on August the 5th, and in 2020, that means it's almost Kentucky Derby time. The Derby is rescheduled for September the 5th this year, and it'll be the second leg of racing's Triple Crown. The Belmont was run back in June, and Joe Manning is with us today. He's the deputy director of the Louisville Story Program, which has produced, among many, many projects, a book called Better Lucky Than Good, Tall Tales and Straight Talk from the Backside of the Track, which tells the stories of some of the people who are at the core of the Kentucky Derby and racing in general at Churchill Downs. The book provides first-person thoughts of people who fill a variety of vital, if not always well-recognized, roles at the racetrack. People like the grooms, the hot walkers, exercise riders. There's a director of the counseling service that's included in the book, a former track superintendent, an outrider, jockeys, a horticulturist, a silk seamstress, and the backstretch chaplain are among those featured in Better Lucky Than Good. And Joe was the editor of the project. Joe, it's good to have you with us. Thanks for taking time today.
Keith, thanks so much for having me. What a great introduction. And it sounds like you've read the book and enjoyed it. That's a pretty good encapsulation of what's going on in the book. We're really proud of it.
Well, thank you. And it is a wonderful compilation of stories in their own words of the people who do so much of the really, really hard work of horse racing that are not usually in the spotlight. Before we get into the book, though, tell me about the mission and the work of the Louisville Story Program.
Sure thing. So the Louisville Story Program is a literary arts outreach nonprofit here in Louisville. We started the ball rolling in 2013, and our aim and our mission is to reach out to folks in Louisville and provide them with the tools and resources necessary to write documentary books about their lives and communities. And this happens in a couple of ways. About half of our books are conducted with young authors, high school authors, and we spend usually about 18 months with a small group of young authors to produce an anthology of nonfiction. We provide a college-level creative writing workshop focusing specifically on nonfiction and the elements of craft, and then they work their tails off to produce these really excellent and really rigorous anthologies. There's no doubt in my mind that our young authors are doing more revision and editing at a higher level than really any other youth project in America. The other half of our projects are what we call our community book series. And when you think of, for instance, folks who work at Churchill Downs, there's not going to be a significant opportunity for folks to sit down in a writing workshop and write their own stories the way they choose to. So what we do is engage in what we think of as like a collaborative ethnography and oral history. So for most of the chapters in the book, I sat down with these participants over the course of 3 years. I would sit down with them a number of times, many, many times, conduct oral histories with them, edit them or transcribe and edit them, and then return them a copy of what I'd come up with. And we would sift through those copies and allow them to sort of edit with us until they had honed a story that was really what they wanted to share with the world. So more than anything, our main objective is to share with our community and with the world the stories of our participants, the stories they want to tell. We do not tell people stories for them. We merely provide the opportunity for folks to say their piece in their own words, really. Does that make sense?
Yes. And tell me about how you determined who you would interview, because there are so many different stories in this book, people with different backgrounds. I mean, they're all involved in the racing business, of course, and working with horses. But how did you narrow it down as to who would be your subjects in this story?
Great question. Yeah. So, you know, we had been existing as the Louisville Story Program for, I don't know, probably four years before the light bulb finally went off and we said, you know, the backside of the track is such a unique and very sort of cloistered community within Louisville, Kentucky. It's the perfect place to do a deep dive project, to do a documentary effort, to really show what our neighbors are up to in South Louisville. And as I say in the introduction, we had about as much understanding of thoroughbred racing as most folks do, which is to say not much at all. Mm. So our eyes were just sort of wide open when we started hanging out on the backside. It's such a unique community. So as we made friends and started poking around and sort of getting an idea about what it takes to put on the races, we landed upon a couple of sort of metrics that we wanted to approach in completing this book. We wanted to give a pretty representative cross-section of folks on the backside, the jobs required. It's almost like these are the people in your neighborhood in some ways. These are the folks who are required to put on a race. We also really wanted to focus on the diversity of the backside. South Louisville is culturally and linguistically it's almost certainly the most diverse area in the state of Kentucky. And that is represented in the communities on the backside. So we wanted to be conscientious of that. And we also wanted to highlight the place itself, the neighborhoods that sort of orbit and support the backside of Churchill Downs and have done so for generations. So those were several of the considerations we had as we, met folks and thought about who we would like to highlight in the book, because, of course, there's 1,000 people that work on the backside, and we only were able to spend time with 32 of them, which was, more than 100 hours of interviews.
I do want to talk to you about some of the individuals, but as you touched on there just a moment ago, one of the goals of the book was to tell the story of a community, the south end of Louisville, in particular the area around Churchill Downs. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of history there, and maybe you could elaborate a little bit on how that community includes so many of the racing people and how the community fits in as a part of the city of Louisville and as a part of the racing industry.
Sure thing. Yeah, it just fascinates me. I'm a Louisville boy. I grew up here my whole life, probably 2 miles from the track, 3 miles from the track tops. And I, like so many Louisvillians, just sort of have a South End-sized blind spot in our understanding of Louisville. It's a working-class neighborhood, has been since the beginning. When they found the site for Churchill Downs 150 years ago when they started building, it was obviously really far away from the city core. It was really a haul to get out to the track. And the city has developed into the southern parts of the neighborhood and of the city. So it's been a working class neighborhood from the get go, and frankly is usually overlooked and marginalized in our gaze of the city of Louisville. These are the types of neighborhoods and communities that we specifically try to think about, because in our estimation, we're certain, we know for a fact, because, it's self-evident whenever you start poking around, that people are living really remarkable, three-dimensional, very vivid lives, no matter where you look. So places that are sort of historically overlooked and communities that are sort of historically overlooked are the places we begin. So there are several neighborhoods that sort of orbit Churchill Downs. One just to the north is a neighborhood that's actually called South Louisville. Many residents call it the Hill, and it's an historically African-American neighborhood. So for generations, so many African-American folks on the backside grew up in the Hill and would come over there one generation after the next. So we were really lucky to hear from some of our elders in our community who could recall some bygone days on the Hill, the days when Jimmy Wingfield was still hanging around the neighborhood, the last African-American to win to ride in the Kentucky Derby and win. Mm-hmm. We got some great oral histories, I think, about that neighborhood. We're so grateful. Another is Highland Park, specifically interesting to me because it's a neighborhood that has disappeared. It's gone now. It was essentially a factory town set up by the L&N Railroad, right where we have Cardinal Football Stadium, that used to be the switching yard for the L&N line. and there was a huge repair shop there. So the neighborhood of Highland Park was set up in, of course, I've forgotten the date, but it was in the 20s or 30s, maybe before, as a working-class neighborhood, and generations of folks went to L&M. Generations of folks went to International Harvester. There was some light and much heavy industry in that neighborhood, and also to Churchill Downs. And with the expansion of the airport in 1991, eminent domain literally wiped that neighborhood off the face of the earth. So, again, generations of racetrackers supporting the backside of Churchill Down, you know, the place where they had grown up, the place that supported the track was disappeared. So we thought it was really important to hear about Highland Park, and we're very lucky to be able to include some of Pat McDonough from the Courier Journal's an amazing photo essay that he did in 91 or 89 and 90, I should say, of Highland Park. So those are a couple of the neighborhoods that have supported the track over the years, and we were really grateful to hear from community members who grew up in those places as a sort of to lend a broader understanding, not just that, you know, people have to come to work at the track, but that the neighborhoods around the track is this generational engine of labor and support that deserves to be sort of considered as we think about racing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the context, maybe the setting, if there was a typical setting for the interviews. You had 32 people that you talked with, and they're going to work at various spots there on the backside of the track. But you want them to be as comfortable as possible when you're talking to them. But in order to get the best stories, what was the best place and time of day, that sort of thing, to interview them?
Well, the answer to that is that we would meet them wherever was most comfortable for them. And frequently we would, you know, knock on the door and poke our heads in a tack room and say, hey, is this a good time or can we meet tomorrow? It was it's a busy place that we were, you know, Keith, when you think about it, for somebody to just show up at your work site and say, hey, I'm working on a book. Who knows when it's going to get published? It's going to be forever. And I really need your attention for recursive interviews over the next couple of years. Are you interested? It was not an easy sell. I don't know if you hang out with a lot of racetrackers, but they tend to kind of glance out of the side of their eyes sometimes, and are not the easiest nuts to crack. So it took a lot of persistence, a lot of showing up, a lot of goodwill, and by, folks kind of got the idea. It was when we landed a bunch of really fantastic photographs from a photographer named Clark Oddie. Just the luckiest thing in the world. We were able to meet Clark, who had binders and binders full of photographic negatives of candid photography that he'd taken on the backside of the track in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. I mean, just a documentary gold mine. So I started hanging around with Clark and interviewing him, and got his permission to make some prints of these old photographs. So for a couple of years, I'd been poking around the track trying to let folks know what I was up to. But when I showed up with these photographs of everybody's old buddies from back in the 70s, people lost their minds, and they sort of got the idea that we were conducting a sort of documentary effort that was a little more broad and a little more in depth than maybe they had understood before. So a lot of times just showing up with those photographs and saying, hey, do you know who this is? Sparked some great storytelling.
And there is some spectacular photography in the book, just a great historical record in itself, in addition to the stories. I wanted to ask you about one of the individuals among several, Christina Bahena. I know I asked you about the pronunciation. Did I get that right? Is Bahena or Bahena?
It's Bahena.
Yep. Bahena. Okay. All right. Her job is listed as foreman. She was working for trainer Dale Romans, who many racing fans might be familiar with. She worked in a factory in Mexico before coming to the U.S., but needed to make more money to provide for her children. She had married very young and had children. And she had some long periods of separation from her family as she got established in the United States, and then eventually, years later, became a U.S. citizen after working on that process for a long time. Tell me about Christina and what you recall from interviewing her.
She's just a remarkable woman, and she's made of stuff than I am. You know, Keith, it's been a while since COVID and sort of being isolated at home. I haven't seen a lot of my track friends recently, and just even thinking about Christina makes me emotional because I'm just absolutely dazzled by her. She's such a strong individual and such a earnest and sweet woman. She's also an extraordinarily hard worker. So, as you said, Christina, you know, she decided that she wasn't able to provide the life she wanted to for her kids when she was younger in Mexico. So she came to America and made a go at it, and it was not easy. She has not had an easy life. And the ways in which she was forthcoming in this process and through the interviews, the ways in which I watched her come to terms with some of the decisions she made was just awe-inspiring. I think it comes across in her chapter. But like I say, you know, as you can imagine, I mean, deciding to leave your kids for an indeterminate amount of time so that you can take care of them in a better way is just an impossibly difficult decision. And that's what she did. And in the, you know, in the intervening 30 years, she's come out on top. You know, she and one of the winningest trainers in Churchill Downs history are thick as thieves, and she's able to provide a great life for her kids. She's sending her kids to college. She became a United States citizen. She's so proud to be here and so proud of that. And we are just, I mean, we in this country are lucky to have Americans like Christina, you know, among us. She's amazing. And her story is, I feel like, at this very moment, the type of story that Americans need to be aware of and need to take seriously. It's really something.
Very often a career path on that side of racing will begin with just asking for a job at the track, and you might be walking horses or mucking the stalls, which is just about as glamorous as it sounds, and the people who are good at it and take on the responsibilities will work their way into more responsibilities, and that certainly happened in her case as she began to gain more trust in the Romans organization.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think you're totally right, and there are so many of the stories in the book are, you know, just as the old adage goes, just about showing up. You just show up one day and somebody needs some help. Somebody's got to walk that horse around the shed row for a while, which, you know, that it's about the easiest thing in the world. You just keep turning left. That's what everybody says. Take the horse by the halter and keep turning left. Mm-hmm. So anybody can do that. And if you keep showing up, you'll be handed more responsibility by and by. Christina talks about going to work in Chicago and being terrified of horses, because guess what? They're terrifying animals. They're huge. They'll bite you, you know. So she has these stories of wondering what the hell she was even doing in the shed row before she got used to it. And now 30 years later, she's a shed row foreman in charge of, you know, riding up the sets and putting riders on horses and making sure that everybody's fed and medicated. It's a lot of responsibility in an organization like Romans Racing.
And those who do work so closely with the horses, as you mentioned, these are thoroughbred racers. They are not pets, and some of them are not exactly the most pleasant-natured animals to be around. So those who work with them really have to know what they're doing and really be willing to take some risks.
Oh, yeah. There's some stomach-turning accounts of being beat up by horses in this book. A couple of folks really, you know, talking about getting kicked around in a shed row or in a stall. I certainly am not cut out for it, that's for sure. I remember once I was talking to one of the assistants and having a look around the shed row and was instructed to sort of keep my back to the stall as a horse was passing. And I did so, and out of nowhere, this horse sticks its head out of a stall, looks at me, and then bites through my shirt and bites my shoulder. I still have a mark
Wow.
on my shoulder. And the trainer said, "Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, she's kind of bitey. That one's called Bad Actor."
Oh, appropriately named. Yeah. Again, the book is Better Lucky Than Good: Tall Tales and Straight Talk from the Backside of the Track. Joe Manning is the editor. He's our guest. Andy Spaulding's story is in the book. He's a retired rider, not a jockey, but one who is involved in breaking and training horses. He's a native Kentuckian, but not from Louisville. He's from Springfield in Washington County. Came from a family of 17 children. Found work at some farms around Springfield, and then made his way to Louisville at and Churchill Downs. And I thought he really had an interesting story to tell about making a living as a writer, which he did for many years.
Yeah, what I'm curious, Keith, what stood out to you about Andy's chapter? What really spoke to you about it?
Well, just the idea that of taking on that work, becoming interested in it. When he talked about how they would determine that you could be something, you could do something for them, was if you got thrown three or four times and managed to bounce back up and get back on a horse, then they would see that you had some value and some determination, and that maybe you could be useful to them. And I thought, well, that's a great deal of determination. And then also just the idea of coming from such a huge family and being outside of Louisville, not really on an inside of the racing industry, and then continuing to make a living as a rider for so many years. So I just thought his just kind of jumped out at me.
Yeah, Andy was among the first folks who I met, and was a real, I mean, really, honestly, if anybody could hear the tapes of some of these interviews, and they can too, they're all, most of them are housed at the University of Louisville Oral History Archives. But I ask a lot of very dumb questions, a lot of rookie questions, and Andy Spaulding and a friend of his, Paul Goffner, were really gracious and sort of running me through the paces and helping me understand horse racing. But Andy's story, I think, is fascinating and really emblematic of, as you say, the ways that the wider bluegrass region and the state of Kentucky are also a supporting element, obviously, of the racing at Churchill Downs and racing elsewhere. Now, I say obviously, but, you know, when you think of Churchill Downs, you think of Louisville, Kentucky, and maybe not necessarily, you know, the so many horse farms and layup farms training facilities around the state required to take care of these athletes and get them ready for the races. So Andy is an African-American guy who came from a Catholic family of 17 in Springfield near Bardstown, Kentucky. And he, you know, by his own account, is just a country boy and made a little bit of money, made a little scratch when he was a kid, taking care of some horses. And then somebody put him on a horse and he just fell in love with it, which is that's one theme in the book that just rings out chapter by chapter. There's just something about these animals and our interactions with them that light some people up. You know, once you get horse bit, that's it. So Andy did whatever he needed to do to keep messing around with horses for his entire life. And then he's visually impaired and essentially blind, and was so for a long time before he retired, actually. And it's just a fascinating chapter that really documents an entire lifetime in horse racing. I mean, Andy's an elderly fellow now in retirement. He lives at a retirement home that was set up primarily for retired racetrackers. It's one block away from the backside. It no longer is just racetrackers who live in their retirement home, but it's just over on the hill, and I would go over there and hang out with he and Paul Goffner and shoot the breeze and just marvel at their recollections of a lifetime in horse racing.
And as you mentioned, he mostly has lost his sight now due to glaucoma and has not been able to be around horses for the last few years. But he said he still gets up at 4 a.m. So that racetracker part of him is still very much there. That's part of the lifestyle, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's also the case with all these racetrackers. You know, this is a job that it sounds like an old chestnut or something, but it is so true that it is more of a lifestyle than a job. These folks work 7 days a week, all year long, for their entire lives. It's just a different way of thinking about labor and getting through, you know, and being paid and making a living than most of us are accustomed to. And it really does get into your bones. So yeah, he gets up every morning, and there's a you know, in the nice weather, there is a daily impromptu meeting of just old racetrackers in the parking lot of the home there. Old dudes who grew up on the track. And to be really honest with you, Keith, I'm still so ashamed of myself, but I was never able to get up early enough to go crash their racetracker party. I always showed up a little too late, and there was a couple of guys that it took me forever to meet. I wanted to meet these old guys, but I couldn't get there early enough.
Yeah, that saying, you have to get up pretty early in the morning to do whatever you're thinking about doing there. In this case, it's literally. Right. You literally have to get up early in the morning to be with those people. Andy was involved in what could be called a miracle. He told that story in his chapter. He was involved in an accident on the track, and the horse he was riding was injured and had to be put down, or so everyone thought. But it didn't actually turn out that way. What do you recall his telling about that event?
Oh, man. I had him tell me that story many, many times. And, you know, one of the things that I love about this book is the candor of it. And to be real honest with you, Keith, there's a lot of glorification of racing that goes along with being from Louisville and talking about the Derby and talking about horse racing. That sometimes is not that sometimes occludes the more difficult topics. And I'll say this: the title of the book is an accurate one. There's straight talk in this book. People talk very clearly about what goes on in racing, and you know, good, bad, and ugly. And so Andy told a story about a horse he was working on that broke down in training, broke its front legs, I believe. It's been a while since I read that part of the chapter. And they had to medically terminate the animal. And he came, they put it underneath a tarp, and he walked away, and that was the end of his day. And he came back the next morning and came around the barn there to where the horse had been, and there was nothing underneath the tarp. And he went further and found that the horse was up and grazing nearby. Now that I'm saying that, I can't remember if I'm getting all the elements right, but the horse that he had seen put down on the track, the medicine didn't take, and a friend of his came through and recognized that something special was going on, and took that animal and rehabilitated it. And I think that animal became, an attraction, or taken to birthday parties and things like that. An animal for kids to ride, or maybe even a training animal. So a pretty wild story. There's more than that in the book, too. The other half of the subtitle is, it's Tall Tales and Straight Talk from the Backside of the Track. And there's a lot of yarns that maybe strain credulity, but were really great to hear over and over again. Racetrackers are the greatest storytellers I've ever met. I worked for an organization called the Louisville Story Program, and it's sort of my job to listen to people tell great stories. And some of the best ones I've ever heard have been on the backside of the track.
Yeah, there must have been some times when you thought, well, I've heard it all now, and then you find out you actually haven't heard it all. there's something else. I wanted to ask you
another story, if you did, quickly.
Sure.
There's a bar over on Central Avenue, and just a divey bar way back in the day that's since been demolished. The owner of the bar, Earl Garr, was kind of the heavy hitter and the mayor of South Louisville. A lot of gambling at his place, and there was a bank there on the corner, First National. And Gar had this bulldog that was always in the bar with him. And on Fridays, another interesting consideration, so much light and heavy industry in the neighborhood, guys would get their paychecks on Fridays. So all the bars on Central Avenue would cash their paychecks for them. Of course they would. Why wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. So every Friday, Gar would go across the corner and get $20,000 in cash out of the bank. And he put $10,000 in his pockets, and he had this little vest or something that he had on his dog So he would stuff $10,000 more dollars into his dog's little backpack or whatever and walk across the corner. So I heard this story from a dude once, and I thought, that is a very funny story, and there's no way it's true. And then a totally unrelated other old guy a year later told me the same story. I thought, now I've heard it all.
Yeah, and if it wasn't true, it was at least well circulated. You know, you had told more than once. Well, that is a fascinating story. And you could only imagine, like you say, if you've gotten to sit in with the early morning session with some of those guys, the lifestyle they lead, it just contributes to things like that that happening over a period of many, many decades. I wanted to ask you about Linda Doan. Her disability was hearing, but she succeeded at a variety of jobs, had an interest in horses early, but then got into racing only after she had earned a bachelor's degree in vocational rehabilitation and a master's degree and went into counseling. So this was someone who was not working in desperate circumstances. She had some other options, but chose to get back into the racing industry in one of those 7-day-a-week jobs that you've been talking about. What do you recall about her?
Linda Doan is just an absolute dynamo. She's just such a bright light and a really, really hard worker and just a good person in her heart. The racing industry is lucky to have her. Yeah, she's a drug and alcohol counselor on the backside of the track. So, and her chapter is, I mean, you know, her vocations, her chosen vocations, are really the results of her lifetime interests. It's amazing to have heard these stories from her. She was the little girl who, you know, got on a pony ride and never looked back and had, you know, blue ribbons tacked to her wall. Every birthday was a new riding crop or some jodhpurs or something. I mean, she's kind of was your archetypal American little girl who loved horses. And that was it for her. She was just off, you know, off into horse shows up through high school. And after high school and after college, she needed a job and so started doing a little bit of this and that with a very small time stable in a rural up north in rural America, and kind of got the bug. She had never done any horse racing up to that point, but started working on the circuit. But prior to that, she had done some counseling work with at-risk teens and later in a drug and alcohol center, if I'm not mistaken. So she also had that interest and went to school and got her counseling certificates. And later in life, was an assistant trainer for a really successful stable for a very long time. And, you know, like we've said, that is difficult work, and a person can be absolutely forgiven for saying, you know what, after 15 and 20 years, I've had enough. I'm done. And if I'm not mistaken, when Linda decided that she was going to stop doing the assistant work, it wasn't long before she found her way into the role of a drug and alcohol counselor on the backside. There's a program that's been longstanding on the backside for many, many years. Now she runs that program, sees a lot of people who are maybe down on their luck or not having the best time, and gives them the tools and resources they need to keep their jobs and keep going and succeed. And she's absolutely the right person for a job. She has a heart of gold and knows the industry inside and out. She's a fantastic chapter in the book. And she was, and if all of that weren't enough, she's also a world-class photographer. She runs a very successful photography business and just is an incredible shooter. So helped us. Actually, if you look in the book, many, many of the portraits that precede the chapters are taken by Linda Doan. She really did us a solid by helping get those portraits for the book.
Yeah, and she's now director of the Healing Place Lifestyle Program at Churchill Downs and Employee Assistance Program, as you mentioned. I thought she had a great quote in the book. She said, it takes a complete village to put on the greatest 2 minutes in sports, the Kentucky Derby, along with many other races. Like other communities, the racetrack community consists of hundreds of people from all walks of life and with all the issues and problems that come with being a human being. It makes sense to reach out to help backside employees to strengthen the working backbone of our racing industry. And I thought that was a really good illustration, a good way to put it, of how the racing community is just that. It's a community that not only has all the things that are part of everyday life, but also the occasional challenges and bumps in the road that people run into.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to think of the backside as a village and to consider, you know, a holistic sort of approach to appreciating that village is totally encapsulated in Linda's work and hopefully in this book. That's the whole idea, is to tell as complete a story as we can, that is humane and very three-dimensional, and to meet people where they are and sort of provide the opportunity for folks to talk about their lives really earnestly and from the inside out. I think, you know, warts and all, this book does that. We're so proud of it and so grateful to the authors who gave so much and of their time and were very forthcoming with their stories. I mean, there's some tough stories in this book, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of celebration and a lot of humor. So I could not be more pleased with the ways in which that sort of complete village notion that you discussed is I think comes right off the page in the book.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation the name of Clark Otte. He was mm-hmm. His father was an attorney, and then he became part of the racing industry as a groom and a photographer. So he would be another one that wasn't coming from maybe really tough circumstances, but had an interest mm-hmm. in the racing industry. And groom and photographer seems like an unusual pairing, but those were his talents that he wanted to pursue. How did that come about for him?
Oh, man. Yeah, he got the bug early. Clark had a grandfather who was a fan of racing, and both his mom and dad were real big fans of racing. And he tells a story in the book. His dad was the Commonwealth attorney in Kentucky. Clark comes from sort of a pretty distinguished background in that regard, though not without its troubles and sorrows. One of Clark's dad's clients gave him this little handheld camera back in the 30s that Clark used for a long time. It's a really beautiful object. I'm looking at a picture of it right now, and it took these remarkable pictures. And, you know, Clark's just a shutterbug, really. He's got a good eye for photos. He loved, like so many photographers, he loved the mechanics of the instrument and sort of was a geek about that. And he also really loved racing. He loved having friends on the backside, and he had a lot of friends, and just was able to get these striking, candid photos of his friends on the backside. Funny story is that we had some friends at the Kentucky Derby Museum who turned us on to Clark just by absolute happenstance. A light flickered on in somebody's head one day, my friend Carla Grego said, "Oh yeah, Clark Otte, I remember now that he has just stacks and stacks of old photos from back in the day." So we had this concept. I just had this itch for a sort of visual concept in the book that would linger on the imagery and the sort of photographic styles of the 60s and 70s as a sort of baseline. And, you know, and lo, here we meet Clark Otte, who just has binders full of these great photos. So it was one of the luckiest things that's ever happened in my professional life. And Clark is a great guy, and I spent a lot of time with him hearing some great stories. He connected us to some really fantastic folks. And like I said before, just having those photos to carry around with an instant ticket to good storytelling. It was just like winning the lottery, frankly.
Yeah. He was quoted as saying in there, and as many do during various stages of their careers in racing, I worked doing everything I could. And as you mentioned earlier, that seems to be a common theme. If you're not willing to take on any task, it's going to be pretty hard to get started and gain the trust you need to continue to move up. That just seemed to be a common thread, along with just the passion for horses and horse racing.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's always something to do, too. I mean, you know, I might push back against that assessment a little bit, because there's always just some very boring, kind of tedious work that needs to be done. There's a lot of that. Mm-hmm. So a person could, you know, show up and just do that for, if you can handle the tedium, you can bop around and find some work to do. And it's and not everybody does, you know, rise to the level of an assistant trainer or a trainer. And Clark's a great example, actually. He enjoyed the closeness of just being with the animals and being in the shed row and hanging out with the guys. He really enjoyed the life of a groom on the circuit, you know, which is a very transient lifestyle that's not for everybody. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of moving around, and a lot of, you know, good times and seeing new places, too. It takes all types and all sort of constitutions, I think, to get the job done.
Yeah, and his summary of his experience I thought was good. He said, I didn't achieve any great success, but I saw a lot of things that are very interesting. I was around interesting people and good horses, so it was worth it to me. Sounds like somebody who doesn't have any serious regrets, although he did have some pretty serious bumps in the road in his lifetime and career, too. But at the same time, he's able to look back on it and take some pride in it and know that he made the choice that was right for him.
Absolutely, and as an interviewer yourself, I think you can understand that when he said that, I thought to myself, "Oh man, got some good tape right there.
Yes,
that's going to look great on the page." Yeah, I remember when he said that. I thought what a concise and great thing for this man to have said in his story, because it speaks to so many folks in the industry who have similar experiences.
Well, we've talked about.
To talk about the ways of, you know, I mean, I'm from Louisville. We're from Kentucky, and we're sort of inundated with the majesty of racing and of the Derby, and the highest echelons of it are where our gaze lands most of the time. Mm-hmm. But there are way more Clark Otties than there are Dale Romanses and so on, you know. There are way more people who spend their life devoted to racing who will never hear about unless we ask, unless we go looking. And that's what this book is about. The folks who you just wouldn't know about unless somebody put their story in front of your face, or unless you hung out on the backside and poked around, you know.
We've talked about some of the individuals in the book. Of course, there are many more. As you said, a total of 32 in all. Are there one or two that you'd like to tell us about that really stood out to you? I know they all were meaningful, but maybe one or two others that you might like to mention as just examples of the kind of people that you talked to and learned about their careers.
There's so many folks, of course, who I met. I don't know who sticks out. I think of my friend Cristobal Trejo. Chris came to America, I don't know, probably 40 years ago. That's about right. I think Chris is about 65, and he showed up when he was 15 or so. So he's been living in America, working with horses for 40-something years, and he is, I can say this with real certainty, somehow the most sort of spiritually dedicated horseman I met in the 3 years that I worked on this book. He has a love of racing and a love for the animal that is boundless. It practically just, you know, just sort of oozes off of him. He cannot wait to talk about horses. He cannot wait to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning before everybody, shave his face and get down into the stables and attend to the animals he's in charge of. You know, he lives above the barn, in the rooms above the shed row, by choice. He actually just recently bought a house because his family finally came to join him in America for a number of reasons. And so after literally 40 years, Chris came down out of the dorm above the barn and got a house here in America with his family. Of course, they had a house back in Mexico, and he would visit them throughout the year. But he stayed up there all those years because he wanted to. He wanted to be close to the horses. And Chris told me a story about his favorite horse ever, who he had this really remarkable connection with. It was another sort of unremarkable animal, yet another animal, another athlete who worked its tail off to run the races and did pretty well, but not one that we ever hear of. This is not, not a Barbaro. This is another one of the horses that runs the races that you just don't really remember or hear about, but which Chris had a very special relationship with. And he told the story of the day when they finally had to say goodbye. The horse had been sold after 3 or 4 years of daily interactions and playing with this horse, spending his own money on apples and peppermints to make this horse feel like $1 million. And he talked about crying for 4 days after the horse moved away, just because it was felt like losing a member of his family. And so his story always just sort of sticks out to me. And Chris and I had a rapport and a friendship that meant a lot to me. One thing about this book and the types of endeavors that we do at Louisville Story Program and my job is that, we're not just sort of dipping in and telling a story or writing a piece, which is very important, and there's a place for that. To get to produce the type of book that we want to produce, it requires us to sort of have in-depth relationships with people. So I hung out with Chris a lot, and he was happy to see me, and I was happy to see him. So, he's a friend of mine. That's what I mean to say, and his story really, really sticks with me. He's a great guy.
Well, it's just a fantastic collection of stories and photos. Better Lucky Than Good, Tall Tales and Straight Talk from the Backside of the Track. That's the name of the book. And I've been talking with Joe Manning, the editor. Joe, where's a good place to find the book?
Best place to find it is at LouisvilleStoryProgram.org. It's also available at your local bookstore. Hopefully your bookstores are doing curbside service. Anybody can just call up your local bookstore and ask them to order a copy. The other regular haunts are also perfectly usable. But try LouisvilleStoryProgram.org or your local bookstore.
Well, it's a wonderful book about people and racing, and timely now, even in late summer here in 2020 when we're coming up on Derby time. Joe, thanks so much for the time today. We appreciate you being with us.
Keith, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.